Impact of Influence, the Murdoch Family Murders. This is the unfolding story of a powerful South Carolina family, the mysterious deaths they are linked to, and our quest to bring you the truth. Hello, friend. So grateful you're spending time with us. Matt Harrison, Seton Tucker, back at it with more Murdoch stuff. We should tell you, we're going to continue the updates of anything Murdoch, even though we have the side podcast about Shanquella Robinson going on right now, which hopefully you're following. But Seton, where can they find us?
You can find us on Facebook, which is Murdoch Podcast, or on our website, which is murdochpodcast.com.
Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to talk to a woman who wrote a book about why women love killers, which leads us to Alec Murdoch, who is, of course, serving two life sentences in a maximum security prison in South Carolina. And his attorney, Jim Griffin, who we've had on before, spoke on the Cuomo show and said that, here's the quote, I'll find the quote here, all right, about Alec. He thinks he can be productive in the general population. He'd rather take his chances on the yard than rot away in a cell, to be honest with you, Griffin told Cuomo. He wants to contribute. There's a lot of things he can do in the general pop. There are programs he can assist with. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that maybe being in this protective unit, you would be very isolated, and maybe he would like to have some other contact with just people in general. I did notice that the warden said in that interview, I think, that he had been receiving threats, but I guess Alec did not receive any direct threats that he was aware of.
Not direct threats, but they've heard about threats. And Griffin said, anytime you're in prison and you're a name like he is, you're going to be challenged. But he was able to overcome and develop relationships, and he was productive in the county jail. Of course, now he's in a different jail. Also, Murdoch news is about the fact that some of the dates are now being released of when these other players in this whole thing will occur.
There was a status conference, I believe, on Friday in front of Judge Newman.
Good old Judge Newman. He's handling all this stuff. They've, you know, cycled it all through him. And let's start with, well, of course, I will start with Alec Murdoch, and he has 102 criminal charges. These are not the murders, dude. These are just 102 separate ones.
And he did not attend this status conference.
Nor did his attorneys. Judge Newman said that they might hold a separate status conference by telephone with Griffin and Murdoch's defense team. And that could happen, they're thinking maybe October. Now, the state versus Corey Fleming. This whole story's been really quiet, right?
Yeah, Corey Fleming, if you don't remember, is Alec's longtime friend who was representing the Satterfield family in the litigation involving the death of their mother.
Right, and defrauding the estate of Gloria Satterfield. So, let's see, when is that one coming up? He's scheduled to stand trial on those charges September 11th in Beaufort County. And they said that'll be a 1 or 2 week trial. Could be interesting in that one, too. Now we also have State of South Carolina versus Jerry Rivers. And Jerry was indicted in August on obstruction of justice charges, later indicted on money laundering and other crimes connected to Murdoch's, as Creighton Waters called it, a stream of illegal money and drugs.
And I think, didn't he have some affiliation with this cowboy gang?
They said loose. I'm not sure that that was proven, like he like lived across the street or something like that. And his court date is August 28th in Collinson County. And then there's Russell Lafitte, who has more stuff going down. And he's already been convicted on the federal charges. And there will be some more charges he will have to face. And now there's a controversy. His new attorneys are saying, I might not be ready in time for the fall.
Because he still has a pending federal court appeal and also defending these state charges.
There'll be another status conference on him coming up. You got the state of South Carolina versus Spencer Roberts. He was indicted on charges in August of 2022 that included money laundering, insurance fraud, narcotics, a whole bunch of things. And that was all part of that stream that we talked about with the alleged story is Murdoch goes to Eddie Smith goes to Rivers and Roberts and does the drug thing. He's standing trial December 18th in Colleton County. And then Curtis Edward Smith versus the state. Cousin Eddie, we know he's been, you should know by now, he was indicted along with Murdoch in this assisted suicide insurance scheme. Now there's been also narcotics charges and drug crimes in a multi-county area related to oxycodone. And you know, was he trafficking it? He also had some possession issues.
It will be really interesting to see if there are any plea deals that happen with these folks and also what plays out with these financial crimes. And maybe we get some answers on where all the money's gone.
And Eddie Smith has been very cooperative, they say, and he's also pretty sick. He has gone under dialysis, is what we've heard, reported by the Greenville News. And we'll see how that progresses because of his illness. It's more likely, I would think, that they're going to do some sort of plea because he's immobile and was not at this hearing as well.
And they're describing him as cooperative.
Yes. All right, let's bring us to our guest. She is Sheila Eisenberg. She's been a writer in one way or another since she was 15-year-old high school sophomore. She's published 4 biographies, and she's also wrote 2 editions of the groundbreaking pop psych true crime book, Women Who Love Men Who Kill. It's on Simon & Schuster and Diversion Books. She has also worked as a reporter, press secretary, college instructor, organizer for New York Radical Feminist, media director for the Woodstock Comedy Festival, and more. And we are pleased to welcome Sheila Eisenberg to the show. And Seton, fire away.
Sheila, we are so excited to have you on as a guest. And I kind of wanted to start out with what made you interested in this subject about why women form these relationships with men in jail?
I did not really get interested in women forming relationships with men in jail. I started out, and I continue to be interested in women getting into relationships with convicted murderers in prison, which is different. In other words, I'm not interested in anything like a woman who's got a relationship with a bank robber or a kidnapper or a carjacker, only with a man who's in prison for murder, so he won't be getting out. He's got a life sentence.
When you first began this journey, how were you able to get interviews with some of these women? Did you have to work it did they right away want to talk?
Well, first of all, I wrote the first edition of the book in 1990. So that was before the internet. And as you can imagine, I had to slog through my research. It was all footwork and grunt work, and finding people without the internet was really hard. I went to the individual prisons. I talked to the wardens. I talked to state officials. I put ads online. Back then, they had support groups for women who were married to or in love with prisoners. I went to those groups. I told them who I was, and I asked them if they wanted to talk to me. And I just really did an enormous amount of footwork to find these women. And then once I found them, I had to convince them that I was someone they would want to talk to. So it was an enormous amount of footwork.
Wow.
What can I tell you? The second edition, which was published last year, was so much easier to do because of the internet.
I bet.
Yeah.
What were some of the reasons that these women started relationships with these men?
Well, they didn't tell me the reasons. Oh. I had to figure it out myself. Nobody said I started a relationship with a convicted killer because of XYZ. I had to interview 36 women for the first edition, which I did. And then I developed a theory on my own based on these interviews because they all had a lot in common. And I developed the theory and wrote it in the first edition. And that's how I became an expert on the subject.
I'm going to say, first of all, I'm guessing that the women might come from different backgrounds and things, right? But yet there's a commonality in another way, right? So explain that.
Exactly. They all came from different backgrounds. They had different education levels, different occupations. Some were married, some were single, some had children, some did not. One thing they did have in common, and this is always very interesting, is that the majority of them were Catholic. So I'm not a theologian, so I never interpreted that because I don't know what it means, but I included that in the book. But what they all had in common, which was glaring at me when I interviewed them, was that they had all been abused women in the past in different ways. Some of them, a small number, thankfully, had been sexually abused as children. Another group had been sexually abused as adults. A large number of women had been physically abused, either by their parents, usually their fathers, or by their earlier relationships if they had been married in the past or had boyfriends. They were victims of domestic violence. I don't call it domestic violence anymore. I call it domestic terror because that's what it is. Some of them had not been sexually abused or physically abused, but had been psychologically abused. But every single one of these women was a victim of abuse and had been hurt in the past.
You talked about how technology changed your research in your second book. And I wanted to talk a little bit about how technology changed with how these women communicated with the men in jail and how they found them.
Well, in recent years, many, many prisoner pen pal websites have sprung up. And I talk about them in the book, and I name some of them. And the most common one, or the most popular one, shall I say, is called writeaprisoner.com. And I interviewed the person who runs that website. But he had a huge number of inmates on his site, and he had a huge number of women coming to the site. And these prison pen pal websites, they're very interesting because the men pay a nominal fee to join. They can put their profile on the site. They can write a biography of themselves and put their photograph up. Now, the biography, of course, will not necessarily be the unvarnished truth. They will write things like, I love to go into the woods, I like bird watching, things like that, all things that they can't really do anymore. Maybe they did it in the past. I don't know. I'm not accusing them of lying necessarily, but, you know, they paint a nicer picture of themselves. They do have to acknowledge the crime that they're in for. That's one of the prerequisites of these websites. They put their biography and their picture up for a nominal fee. Then the women go on the website and they scroll through the bios and the pictures and they pick the men they want to communicate with. They write an email. They send it to the website. The men cannot get these emails. So the website translates the email into hard copy and gives the men the printed pages containing the emails. Then the men pick out the women they want to respond to and they write a responding hard copy and give it to the website, who then turns it into an email and sends it back to the woman. And that's how the communication goes.
One thing I noticed that you said in the book was the more notorious the criminal, the more appealing they seem to be to some of these women. Do you have a theory on why this is?
I divide the women and the men basically into two categories. A man who's committed a murder in a small town or even in a big city who does not get a lot of publicity, I call him a garden variety killer. He's not well known. And the only way he gets into a relationship with a woman is if she works in the prison and gets to know him that way, or if she comes into the prison through some other way, like she's in an advocacy group. Or several women were journalists, One was a nurse, one was a social worker. They interact with the prisoners through their work, basically. Or they work inside the prisons. Mm-hmm. That's how they come to know the prisoners. The second group of prisoners get a lot of publicity on TV and in newspapers, podcasts, radio, internet. And because they get so much publicity, they come to the attention of people who watch the news or listen to the news. And the women who contact them are basically very different from the first group of women. The first group of women are the women I mentioned earlier who've been abused and are seeking certain things in a relationship with a prisoner. I don't know if you want me to go into that.
Absolutely.
Do you?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Okay, well, the first group of women, which is larger, if you've been abused in your past, be looking for a relationship that's safe. And even though it seems counterintuitive, a relationship with a convicted murderer behind bars is safe because he can't hurt you. He's not getting out. Mm-hmm. He's not going to be able to hit you. He can't do anything to harm you. And you're in control of the relationship. And perhaps for the first time in your life, you're in the driver's seat when it comes to a relationship with a man. You decide about phone calls, visits, how much money to put in his canteen.
Okay.
And if he's trying to get out, you're his advocate with his lawyer. You know, you have a lot of power. And for many of these women, it's the first time they have this power. And it's basically a safe relationship where they have power. So it reverses the roles they've been in their previous life. I know it sounds counterintuitive and strange, but that's what I figured out.
Makes sense.
The second group of women, which is smaller, who are writing letters to Alex Murdoch and other notorious criminals, are very different. I'm not saying whether or not they've been abused, because I don't know about all of them, obviously. But these are women who are seeking publicity for themselves. They want their 15 minutes of fame. And they usually get it. So that any notorious criminal who ends up marrying one of these women, her name will be in the newspaper also. For example, I have in front of me, I looked up Alex Murdoch and the women who are writing to him. And I discovered how many letters he's getting. And one of the news outlets had the dates and the names of the women, and they had quotes from his letters. So these women all are getting their 15 minutes of fame. They're online. Mm-hmm. They're famous. And some of them will be selected by you, and they will be interviewed by you, and then their last names will be in the paper or in your podcast, and they will get their 15 minutes of fame, and that's really what they're looking for. I write a lot in the second edition about people's need to be acknowledged as individuals and to be important and not to just be anonymous. And this helps with that. It helps a woman feel she's not nobody. She's going to stand out in the world. She's going to be somebody. And the fact that she's going to be somebody by being the girlfriend of or the wife of a serial killer or someone who murdered his family or one of those heinous murderers takes second place to the fact that it gives her a sense of importance.
Some of these women will try famous killer after famous killer after famous killer till they find someone. Is that true or do you know?
Some of them, yeah. I mean, I don't really know the answer to that for sure. I've never really followed a single woman writing to a notorious killer, right, see if she writes to another one. But I do know of a few cases where a woman got involved with a notorious murderer, and then when that didn't work out, went on to another one, yes.
It seemed to me that loneliness seemed to be another factor of these women communicating with these men.
Which ones? The ones with the notorious killers?
Or any of them. It seemed like women who are reaching out to these murderers in jail seem that a lot of them seem to be lonely.
Well, you know, if you get down to the most basic things, we all have a human need to be loved and to be in a relationship, right? Mm-hmm. So some women are lonely and some women are bored. And I've had women tell me they were bored, so they started scrolling through writeaprisoner.com. I've had women tell me they were, lonely, looking for love. And if you can't get it in real life, maybe you go to a dating website, or maybe you go to a prison pen pal website. Mm. But it's all part of the human condition. Everyone wants to be in a relationship. It's the pressure that we put on people to be in relationships. And it's not just pressure. It's also the human need to be in, to be important, to be cared about by somebody, to be someone's significant other. And also, we look at these women and we say, wow, what's with them? And, you know, a lot of people dismiss them as crazy, which I definitely do not, obviously. But if you think about it, think about your best friend and think about the man or the woman that he or she is in love with. Have you ever said to yourself, what does she see in him? Or what does he see in her? And you're baffled, right?
Right.
So this is the same thing, only on a different level. What does the woman writing to Alex Murdoch see in him? Well, we don't get it. But what we can get, if we really examine it, is she's lonely. She wants to be loved. And maybe she was one of those abused women, and she wants to be known. She doesn't want to live and die in anonymity. So if she can get Alex Murdoch to marry her, her name's going to be in the paper. She's going to be somebody.
It seems like a lot of these women are convinced that the men that they're in these relationships with are not guilty of the crime, or there's some sort of justification for the crime.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think these women really believe they're innocent?
They really believed that the men were, if not innocent, then in some way the crime was explainable. I had a woman tell me that, oh, yeah, he pulled the trigger, but that's because someone bumped into him.
Oh, jeez.
Or he was drunk, or he was on drugs, or his friends made him do it, or he was young. Or the biggest one of all is, he did do it, but now he's in prison and he's found God.
Oh.
He's a changed man. Or if, even if he didn't find God, he's a changed man. Mm-hmm. He's grown up. He's different. He's not the same person. There's all kinds of justifications for it. Sometimes, like Ted Bundy, I don't know if you know this, but he got married while he was on trial. Do you know that?
I read that, yes.
So then, but Carol Ann Boone, she truly believed that he was innocent. But later on, when she realized that he wasn't innocent, that he was guilty, she divorced him.
Oh, just so, didn't know that.
Yeah, usually these women will find either some proof in their minds that he didn't really do it, he didn't really mean it. They were justifying or mitigating circumstances, but when they can no longer believe that and they are faced or confronted with the fact that, hey, this guy really is a killer, then they get rid of him.
Do they have any interest in having sex with these guys?
Oh, that's a really good question. The 30 women I interviewed, or 3 dozen women I interviewed, had no interest in sex. As a matter of fact, the no sex thing was a big part of the relationship. I write about it in the first edition. I call it the King Arthur Knights of the Round Table thing, where the woman's up on a pedestal and he's writing love letters and poetry and he's worshiping her from afar. But that's about it.
A lot of these women like the fact that these men had nothing else to do than just think about them.
Yes.
Focus on.
Yes.
Focus their attention, right. 100%.
Yeah, it was pure romance. I write about romance with a capital R, you know. It's, where else can you get someone to give you that much attention?
This is true. Yeah, Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about him cheating on you either.
Exactly. You don't have to worry about anything.
Right.
Except helping him get out of prison if that's what you want to do. But that, you know, the counterintuitive part is a lot of these women get involved with their man's paroles and attempts to get out of prison, even though once they do, generally the relationship's in.
Oh, never thought about that.
Because the relationship can only flourish while he's inside prison, because the prison walls create the environment within which she's in control, he can't hurt her, and all of the things I discussed.
I found your book so fascinating. Matt, do you have anything else to ask her?
No, this has been great. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us, and hopefully people will pick up the book. So thank you so much.
You're so welcome, Ray.
I really enjoyed your book, and thanks again for coming on.
Oh, thank you. You're welcome.
Sheila Eisenberg, that's Eisenberg with an I, .com, and the book, Women Who Love Men Who Kill, 35 True Stories of Prison Passion.
And you can find it on Amazon. I listened to it on Audible because I had a lot of driving to do.
And we're going to talk about your chili, because during the Alec Murdoch trial, there was a lot of talk about dead hogs and hog hunting and the wild boar meat that comes along with it. And so you found some wild boar.
Yes, I was in the grocery store the other day, and I was shocked to see that they had it just a package of wild boar meat. And it actually came from Texas, not South Carolina. But I left it that day. I said, no, I don't think I can do it. But then it kept, I just kept thinking about it. So I went back to the grocery store, and I got the wild boar meat and said, I'm going to try to make some chili out of this. So I did yesterday.
Yeah, and?
Well, it was too gamey for me, but my husband and son really liked it. My daughter refused to even try it.
Refused to even try it?
She's very picky.
Yeah, I know. My kids wouldn't try it either, probably. But you would have just told them it was pork. I don't know. So, yeah, it's was a big deal during the trial. They talked about how sometimes they would give away the meat and other times they let nature take its course, that sort of thing. So you had a chance for wild boar. And we're wrapping. We have our second case we're doing, the Shenquella Robinson. We released one episode, pretty good response. And so episode two is on its way. And as always, we're grateful. And where can they find us?
You can find us on our Facebook page, which is Murdoch Podcast, or our website, which is murdochpodcast.com.
As always, grateful. We'll talk soon, friend.